Welcome to the second and hopefully of an ongoing series of podcasts in which Emma and myself will be talking about the way that politics and culture interacts. Today, on our episode, dear listener, we'll be talking principally about Sam Bourne's new novel, To Kill the President, and we'll be also discussing Donald Trump more generally, because the novel is basically about the assassination, or the attempted assassination, spoiler alert, of a very Donald Trump-like president. But as we will do in all of our podcasts, we just want to round up what's been going on in the world of politics and culture since we last spoke, which was, I think, sometime in July. And in regard to that, Emma has been in Edinburgh, and she's come hot foot from the frozen north.
Cold foot, it was cold.
It's always cold in Edinburgh. Why is it always cold in Edinburgh?
I'm being unfair, it was a lot drier than it was last year, so it was actually quite
right.
Nice.
Well, the last time I was in Edinburgh at Easter, it snowed, so that's my, you know, experience.
Okay, well, anyway, we have snow.
we're not talking about Edinburgh and its weather, but about the actual festival, because I read something in The Guardian, because I've just been stuck at home doing stuff. I read in The Guardian that it's more political than ever, Edinburgh. So is that right?
I think they say that every year. I think, you know, every year it's like, oh, it's more political than ever. I mean, these are very political times. You know, we're not in sort of boring politics times. So, of course, there's going to be a lot of reaction to that. And, yeah, the fringe has always been quite a left-wing thing. There are some right-wing comedians and they do shows, but they are in a very small minority. And so what you've got instead of left and right is various flavours of left from, say, someone quite centrist like Matt Ford, for example, to Chris Coltrane, who is very much on the sort of hard left.
So was there any influence of Corbyn fever in Edinburgh? I mean, in terms of the political comedy that you might have seen, or political dramas that you might have seen?
I think it would be harder to tell in Edinburgh, because it was sort of always like that.
Right.
So, yeah, you the people who were Corbynites before it was trendy were in Edinburgh anyway. And it probably was trendy, but you know what I mean. And so I don't know that Edinburgh has shifted massively in terms of its politics. You probably got more reaction from those people who had thought that by this point Corbyn would have been a busted flush, having to sort of say, well, hang on, I got that wrong. Matt Ford was very, very strong on that. You know, there was a sort of, well, he didn't win, but actually he did a great deal better than we expected to, and I had to put my hands up sort of thing.
Yes. So is there by the time our listener hears this podcast, Edinburgh will be all over. So is there anything that you recommend that they should have seen but now can't see?
Politics-wise? Well, Matt Ford was very funny. Aisha Has Eureka, whose show I didn't see in Edinburgh, but whose show I saw one of her preview shows in Soho. Politics being what it is, I suspect she'd changed about 50% of the material by the time she got to Edinburgh. But she was very good. I saw a really interesting show, which wasn't quite comedy. It was sort of an amusing lecture, as it were, called Conspiracy Theories, by a guy called, I think it's Marcus Sullivan? Marlon Solomon, who's Jewish and left-wing, and sort of talks about how difficult that's been over the last few years. And that was a really, really interesting. You know, he went through in quite some detail the sort of networks where the hard right and the hard left meet, and then the not so hard right and the not so hard left also meet around conspiracy theories and things like David Icke. And he says, living in Manchester and seeing 3,000 people going to see David Icke is quite a disturbing thing when you know what he's saying.
I would, as someone else who also lives in Manchester, I would hasten to add that probably a lot of them are actually from Manchester. But I couldn't possibly say that for sure. But
I think it was just that was the venue, that he was aware of the size right. of the venue. And, you know, this guy who is being blatantly anti-Semitic is filling that yes. venue to yes. be blatantly anti-Semitic.
And yes. Well, anyway, so that was your big take from Edinburgh. But talking about amusing conspiracy theories, Paul Mason play Why Is It Kicking Off Everywhere was put on BBC Two. It was actually broadcast on BBC Two, and I just wondered, you know, what you thought about that, because it was I thought it was interesting. First of all, that Paul Mason thought it was worth his while. Putting together essentially his argument, his take of the crisis in Europe that followed the financial crisis, he dramatised it. It was kind of interesting. It was also amusing, and it was done in a quite an innovative way. It was staged in an innovative way, and also that it made onto TV. So I thought it was interesting why a journalist of the stature of Paul Mason thought it was worth his while. He's done another play subsequently as well, but. I just wondered what your take on that was, because I thought I'm not someone that really accepts the Paul Mason view of the world, but I thought he put across his argument in a very effective, like I say, amusing, self-reflective, but nonetheless it was a Paul Mason take on the crisis in Europe and how people responded to it.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, isn't it? I think that particularly with the fake news phenomena. That people are going on and on about is undermining a lot of trust in straight journalism. But actually, what isn't really being discussed is actually how much the way that we talk about culture just insidiously affects our political beliefs and understanding. And I think that's where Paul Mason's been quite interesting and clever and gone, you know, I don't think many people are going to watch if I did an hour-long documentary on this, but if I did an hour-long drama, cast some pretty people, you know, make it a gripping, then actually I can start to change people's minds. And I think that's an interesting perspective that he's latched onto.
No, and I think, I mean, it's not uncommon, actually, having you know, said it's surprising that Paul Mason's done this. There are, I mean, Winston Churchill wrote a novel all the way back before he just became an MP. So politically engaged people have used novels and plays and films to get their messages across.
Well, our focus last month was on exactly the same sort of thing, you know, a what-if novel about a potential Ben-led Labour government.
Yes, and the novel that we'll be talking about in a minute is also, I think, part of that tradition. But I thought it was interesting, and I thought it was engaging. But then I looked at the BARB figures, which are freely available on the internet, and I looked at what audience Paul Mason got for his play. Well, it was broadcast about 10 o'clock on a Saturday evening on BBC Two. So you know you're not going to get a mass audience for it anyway. But it wasn't even in the top 30 for BBC Two's shows that week, which meant it got an audience somewhat below a million, which is somewhat less than Dad's Army, for example, got that week. So although the aspiration, I guess, was for him to go out and talk to and engage with people that might not otherwise be reading his stuff, I'm not entirely sure that he did reach that audience.
You think it was just preaching
audience.
To the converted?
Yes, I think so. And I think that's sometimes the case with overtly political drama and fiction, which brings me quite neatly, as if I'd not even been thinking about this link, between to Poldark, the series Poldark, which actually Paul Mason himself used it for a column to talk about how Poldark, which for non-viewers is set in the 18th century Cornwall, it's a time of great turmoil. The Wollaghan family is this kind of prototypical early capitalist kind of monsters who are trying to kind of own everything and turn everything to profit and destroying the Cornish way of life. And Poldark, Ross Poldark, is a squire, an impoverished squire, so he's part of the landed gentry, but he identifies very closely with you know, local tin miners, agricultural workers who are rioting, and also small businesses generally. So he's a kind of evocative figure of resistance to the onset of big capitalism. And Paul Mason used Poldark as a way of having a go at the contemporary tourists by drawing a parallel between these rapacious Warleggans, these kind of terrible Tories, and the current Tory party, to basically draw the lesson, say, well, if you're continuing to be these terribly avaricious, you know, capitalism, neoliberalism, red in tooth and claw, like the Warleggans Tories, well, you're not going to do very well. So he was trying to draw some kind of a lesson from what I think many people who watch it, and it's 6 million, I did check, about 6 million people watch Poldark, may not necessarily have drawn from the series.
No, and I think that is probably the more interesting aspect, isn't it? It? Rather than doing something that is overtly designed to be talking about politics and therefore will only be switched on, particularly in this days of mass channels and choices.
Yeah.
You know, you're not stuck with watching the drama on BBC Two because there's only the snooker on the other side. So you have to opt in much more with TV these days. Now, I don't watch Poldark because I don't fancy Aidan Turner. And my understanding is the only reason to watch Poldark is if you fancy Aidan Turner. So, I mean, this is certainly what I've got gathered from Twitter. But if a lot of women are switching on because they fancy Aidan Turner and are receiving this message that, you know, rapacious capitalism bad, that might actually have a lot more effect on the way they think than not watching Paul Mason's BBC Two drama.
This is exactly, I mean, funnily enough, this is exactly what I think so too. I mean, I looked at, I'm interested in period dramas from the 1970s, and Poldark was one of those period dramas because it's a remake, what we're watching now. And it was exactly the same. The stories were exactly the same. And I thought it was very hard to miss the big message. You know, these Warleggans, these are capitalists and they're bad people and they should be resisted. And it kind of shows, you know, how the upper classes and the lower classes can resist. And in many ways, I was looking at it thinking, as a historian, it's just like an article that this famous historian E.P. Thompson wrote about the moral economy of the 18th century, where he was discussing about bread riots. And I thought, this is E.P. Thompson, a Marxist historian, kind of depicted on the screen that millions of people are watching it. The question is, of course, you know, are people just seeing the ruffled shirts and or not, you know, seeing the chest of Poldark? And the episode that I saw, it was all people riding horses across the beautiful Cornish coastline. So, you know, people aren't necessarily, it's not foregrounded, but maybe more insidiously, they may get a message from it that they wouldn't get from watching a play by Paul Mason that bangs on about how terrible neoliberalism is.
Yeah, I mean, I think subtle messages are often a lot more effective than in your face, because in your face generally either puts you off or you're already there. I mean, I think that an awful lot of the way that we talk about the class system is based on some quite old-fashioned notions that keep being reinforced because we keep doing these period dramas. Yeah, you know, from Upstairs, Downstairs to Downton Abbey, The Crown at the moment, you know, all of this stuff. It's, you know, oh no, it's just part of the drama. But actually, it just reinforces this sense, this stratification that we have in our society. And that we think is completely normal. And then you go abroad and you talk to someone from, you know, not even someone from, you know, somewhere that different, Australia or someone, they're like, they just think it's bonkers.
Well, talking of insidious messages, again, that's such a great link that I'm doing there. Another thing that's happened since we last talked is that Dunkirk, the film Dunkirk, has been released. And in terms of how people have interpreted the film Dunkirk, I've seen a tweet from Nigel Farage saying all youngsters must watch this film, although he doesn't necessarily say why, but there's an implication there. And I've seen people say, well, this is a film which completely validates my own point of view about the pointlessness, futility of war, and all points in between. But the most significant one, or the set of takes from Dunkirk, is, oh, it must be about Brexit. It's got to be about Brexit? What is it saying about Brexit? Because, you know, obviously Dunkirk, for, in case the listener is not aware, is maybe from a foreign country. Dunkirk was when British troops were enforcibly kicked out of Europe by German forces in 1940, and Britain stood alone after that against the might of Nazism, and has been taken, Dunkirk that is, as a kind of a metaphor for all kinds of things. Subsequently, the invocations of the Dunkirk spirit was used to be a standby in politicians, for politicians in the 50s and the 60s, about we've got to put our noses to the wheel, we may be up against it, but, you know, we can all show true British pluck. And Dunkirk was this a useful historical reference point, which kind of died off, I think, in the from the late 60s into the 1970s. There'll be people better placed than me that would be able to tell me that, but it certainly was a trope that was very familiar to politicians of a certain generation, and it's becoming so again, maybe partly due to Brexit, but also the film itself, Dunkirk. But I mean, I saw the film twice, and you've seen the film, Emma. So what? I'm not entirely sure it's explicitly designed for those of the non-male gender. I think, I don't know. But what did you think about Dunkirk as a film? And did you get any message about Brexit from it?
I thought it was a very, very good film. I was slightly worried beforehand because I'd heard there wasn't a lot of dialogue. And I tend to drift in films where there isn't enough dialogue. For me, I'm a talky person. You can probably gather that. So, yeah, I was worried that I would drift, and I didn't. And I think that's partly, and lots of people have said this is not an original observation, but the soundtrack is amazing. And it just drags you into the drama at every single possible moment. And that ticking that's sort of under a lot of the scenes, you know, it really, it does just keep you on the edge of your seat all the way through. And it was nice length. It was proper film length rather than going on and on like most films do these days. So that was good. I mean, in terms of the Brexit stuff, I mean, isn't Christopher Nolan American?
To be honest, I don't know. I should have researched.
It may be a film that is about a British story, but it's a it's an American film. It's got a British cast, but it's a very American film. I'm not sure they cared that much about Brexit. I mean, Donald Trump tries to use it as a metaphor for himself, and I think there were some. I mean, there were some interesting messages. The Dunkirk spirit, I think, has often been invoked as the little guy. You know, it's not just we must put our noses to the wheels, but this is the little guys coming together. And, you know, you can see how Nigel Farage could turn around and go, it's us against the establishment. Churchill was only going to bring back 30,000 and we brought up 300,000, and that's the Dunkirk spirit. And you could take that message from the film, absolutely, and it's definitely in there. You know, the bureaucracy don't care. So we have to do this ourselves.
To ourselves,
And that, you know, that could be quite a, you know, us versus the establishment message. But there are other indicators in there that it, you know, that make it a little bit more complicated than that. So the Kenneth Branagh character at the end is like, no, I'm staying for the French. Well, you know, that, as somebody who is an ardent Ramona or whatever they call me these days, I saw that as a, you know, Europe stands together kind of a message. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think the film was made with a Brexit in mind, and certainly most of the people I've heard praising it probably voted against Brexit, just because those are the people I listen to. So, but I do see how anybody could take any message they want to from it.
Yes, because we're so, well, if only because it was depicting Dunkirk, and Dunkirk has got these prior kind of meanings which are attached
and
to
I'm
it,
not, again,
then
I'm
they
not
just
sure
take
the
those
Americans
meanings as
know
they will.
That. Like, in the same way that we do, I don't think they've internalised Dunkirk in the way that we have.
No.
So
no, they haven't.
They just saw a really good story that you could make a great film out of, whereas we're like, yes, that's the British spirit. It's the bulldogs and the warm beer and stuff, and Harry Styles. Oh, I do.
Yes.
Just for the record.
Yeah. Well, he was hard to. I mean, I barely knew who he was, and he wasn't that easy to pick out out. But
he didn't have the big floppy hair.
No, that would have been a bit anachronistic. Yeah. And when I went to see the film, as I say, I went to see it twice. I went both times for the noise and for the thrill. I mean, I thought it was. I don't go to the cinema as much as I should, but it evoked. It was like Mad Max, the remake of Mad Max. It was just a lot of noise, a lot of stuff was going on, and you just went with it. You just went with the journey, and so it was a visceral experience.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it at the IMAX. It was like, which was exactly the right way to see it.
Had this weird screen
speech
as well.
From the BFI IMAX beforehand going, this is amazing screen, and I'm like, really? This is not setting me up to see a film. I'm really glad you're really proud of your widescreen cinema, but like, I don't give that speech every time I turn my deli on.
So I think this is kind of, maybe it's having, you know, I'm just putting my professor's hat on, it's an example of how a text, I mean, the people that make a film or a TV or whatever, play, novel, they've got their own intentions, and those intentions can, you know, and certainly with Nolan, he was very interested in Dunkirk as a story well before Brexit was even a thing.
Yeah.
So, and it takes a long time to make a film. And it's an example of how a text can be appropriated by the audience who goes in with, if you want to see it, it's about Brexit and about how Brexit's a great idea, that's what it's about. And if you've got a strong enough opinion, that's what you'll make it about. Mm. You'll see what you want to see. And I think Dunkirk, if only because it's kind of empty. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's like, I mean, I don't think there were many words. I think there was fewer words in Dunkirk than we are going to have spoken during this podcast, frankly. And so there are no words, but lots of images. It kind of allows you to take whatever you want to take from it, I think.
I looked it up, and Christopher Nolan is described as a British-American film writer, but was born and, I think, grew up over here. So he has internalised Dunkirk, so that is worth knowing.
Yes, yes. And also, it's because, you know, it's interesting that actually Dunkirk has got a progressive lineage to it. Mm. It was actually J.B. Priestley, who was a bit of a lefty at the time. He took up Dunkirk as the little ships were like the little people, and the little people were rescuing the establishment. Yep. And by that, he meant the right wing, conservative, uncaring establishment that had let Britain into crisis. And it is, of course, ironic that then Nigel Farage could appropriate it for exactly the reverse political purposes. But I think the film itself stays well away from any of that. It doesn't have a position. It's very understated if it does have a position. And I think maybe it comes closest to some kind of a message when, as you say, Kenneth Branagh's character says, I'm staying for the French.
Yeah.
And that's it. Yeah.
I mean, I think the other interesting thing, and this is true of most non-propagandist war films, so most war films that are about war but aren't made during the war, is, again, you can, depending on your own stance on war, the futility of war, pacifism, what have you, you can take your own reading from the film.
Yes.
It didn't shy away from how awful it was. But at no, and there was the soldier who didn't want to go back and fight, but nobody was sort of saying, we shouldn't fight the Nazis, actually we should be talking to the Nazis. So you can both take a war is awful and shouldn't happen perspective from the film, but you can also take a war is awful but is sometimes essential.
I mean, I think this is definitely, Dunkirk is definitely of the war is hell, but it's sometimes necessary. And as you say, there's nobody on the beach saying, okay, why don't we have a little discussion with those people that are trying to kill us at the moment? It is, we have to get off this beach and we've got to get home because basically Britain's next. And then I think, well, definitely one character does say, then if after us, it's the world. And yeah. I think that is directed at the American audience, actually.
Possibly. And one of the characters reads out Churchill's famous speech, doesn't he, to Parliament?
Oh, yeah, right at the end.
At the end. So, you know, we will fight them on the beaches, we will keep fighting them stuff, is, you know, comes very much through. And it is that, both the sense that, you know, this isn't the end. This is the nadir, but it's not the end.
It's not even the beginning of the end, as Churchill did say in that speech. Yeah, so So Dunkirk, and I keep thinking I should go for a third time, but I think that's going borderline obsessive if I do. But
I think it's your girls' trip instead. So.
Well, I might, yes. Not on my own, though. I'll have to find someone to go with me for that one. But anyway, we've done our best not to talk about Donald Trump.
Well, we have been talking about Nazis, so, you know.
Hang on a minute. He only sympathizes. He only thinks there may be some good people amongst that crowd. He doesn't necessarily think they're all good people. Anyway, I'm trying to get some balance in here. We're not obliged to have balance, but I thought I might throw some in. We are going to talk about the novel the novel To Kill the President. But before we do, it would be difficult, particularly given the proximity and this podcast is being produced within a few days of Donald Trump's various reactions to the Nazi demonstration and the death of a protester in Charlottesburg. So we thought it'd be interesting to talk about the reaction, how at least people that you wouldn't necessarily think as being political in an overt way, the talk show hosts really have responded to Donald Trump's response to Charlottesburg, because there was a very
universal reaction.
Charlottesville. Thank you very much. So you pointed me to the reaction of the various talk show hosts.
Yeah. Emma. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. The late night talk shows are such a staple of Americana. They've been around since I think the 50s.
Yeah.
They're huge. Everyone, all the Hollywood stars go on them, and big politicians go on them. They were criticised for humanising Donald Trump. Jimmy Kimmel, I think it was, had him on quite
Jimmy
a bit.
Jimmy Fallon,
that's it.
I can now show that you're wrong. Jimmy Fallon, yeah.
And they have been, they're just an absolute staple of American life. And not really ever seen as particularly one way or the other. I think you could probably guess which way Johnny Carson voted.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wasn't... And they've always opened with a topical monologue. But they generally just kind of do a bit of one way or the other. You know, this is what's happened. Here's some fairly bland jokes about it. But this week, they all just stood up and went, there is no two sides when one side is Nazis. And, you know, were really almost leading the opposition to Donald Trump's press conference on the Tuesday. That's partly because of the timing of the press conference. The press conference was sort of mid-afternoon in New York. So they would have been the first big thing that would have responding to. But it was quite... It felt like an extraordinary moment for them to all say, no, we cannot remain silent in response to this just because half our audience... voted for Trump.
Yeah, although I don't know. I mean, the late night talk show audience, I'm not entirely sure that many of those would have necessarily voted for Trump. I think there's a definite bias in the demographic. But you're absolutely right. They have a kind of important cultural kind of position in American life, which we don't have. There's no real equivalent, I don't think. People have tried to establish a late night spot and failed. But in America, they definitely do have a role, and it normally is bipartisan. You know, have a joke at Bill Clinton's expense, have a go at a Republican. You know, it's kind of like that. And I think Trump though has kind of forced them to. I mean, Jimmy Fallon got into some trouble by humanising Trump, by having him on and treating him, you know, in a certain way that he would just treat anybody else.
Yeah,
and he was criticised for that. But since then, I think they've all basically, it's jokes at Trump's expense and comments at Trump's expense. And it was very, very, you know, interesting how they treated Trump's kind of retraction. The retraction, because he was kind of forced to say something that was condemned all the Nazis. And then he did his retraction when he should have been talking about infrastructure on that Tuesday. And Jimmy Fallon, who maybe there was some overcompensation here, I don't know. But Jimmy Fallon, there were no jokes. He just gave a speech about how terrible Donald Trump's reaction to Charlottesville had been. There were no jokes.
No.
It wasn't done in a jokey way at all. It was
not
a serious
standard
speech.
Opening monologue, and none of them were.
Well, they all had, well, apart from him, they all had jokes. They were doing the kind of shtick, but it was nonetheless, they were making
they
very
but much
straight...
fewer jokes. It wasn't like joke, yes, joke, yeah. band leader no. does a drum roll, which yeah. is what you standardly get in these things.
Sure, yeah. No, no, absolutely. I mean, I read somewhere, with some, well, somebody asked a question because you know, Donald Trump is not like normal American presidents. This is something, this is an event that really did require the American president to make a moral stand yeah. against Nazism. So the question was, given that Donald Trump isn't making that stand, who should make that moral stand? And we were getting a bunch of comedians taking a moral stand, weren't we?
Yeah, I mean, you had James Corden, who's British, taking a stronger leadership role in the country than the president of the United States. It's quite extraordinary.
Yes. I mean, so definitely, and the thing about those, about all these responses is they're all on YouTube and they're all being tweeted and yeah. and that they will go beyond the audience that, that would have seen it. And it's definitely, they're definitely worth watching. And it may be, you know, I mean, I wonder how comedians, satirists, if you will, have been able to respond to Donald Trump. Because the classic thing about satire is you're meant to make something ridiculous, yeah. make people realise that this problem is ridiculous. You just yeah. hold it to ridicule in order for them to appreciate how it should be changed.
Yeah.
Now, the problem for Donald Trump is he is so ridiculous. What do you satirise? And I yeah. saw recently something called The Art of the Deal, which is kind of a jokey version of that book
yeah.
He wrote. Which was done last year, so it's, you know, he's a candidate and everything, and it really wasn't very funny because Donald, cause basically the lines were Donald Trump's lines, you know,
yeah.
how do you make them funny? So it's, and I think, I mean although Alec Baldwin, you know, on Saturday Night Live has done a good job as an impersonation.
In fact, maybe we could hear a little bit of that right now.
Okay.
We all love Trump, don't we? We do, we do. I just had an amazing week, folks. I met with leaders from China, Egypt, and Jordan. Gorsuch was confirmed. The media is saying nice things, and no one is talking about Russia. Wow, what a difference just 59 Tomahawk missiles can make.
I recently got laid off from a coal mining plant.
And as president, I promise I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you people work in coal for the rest of your lives. And your kids will work in coal, and your grandkids, and it's going to be incredible.
Mr. President, thank you so much, but all we want are good jobs. They don't have to be in coal.
Sorry, hombre, it's all coal. In Trump's America, men work in two places, coal mines and Goldman Sachs.
I actually want to talk about Obamacare. Since I signed up, my premiums have gone up, and I have to drive 90 minutes to see a doctor.
I'm talking with the Freedom Caucus, and we're going to get rid of it.
Okay. You're going to get rid of my health care? Like all of it?
All of it. Gone. After we're done, you'll never have to drive to see a doctor again. How does that sound?
There you go.
So there are you know, they can be funny, but I just wonder what are they doing in terms of are they, because I guess most of these most comedians are really critical of Donald Trump, and they would like Donald Trump's politics to stop, Donald Trump maybe to stop being president. Are they able to persuade people? That this is something, you know, are they really literally able to persuade people that voted for Donald Trump that it was a bad idea? Jimmy Kimmel made his monologue really all about that. You know, he addressed his monologue to so those people that vote for Donald Trump. Like I say, I'm not sure how many people who vote for Trump would be watching Jimmy Kimmel, but if they
I don't know, because watching late night has always been just a thing that people do before they go to bed. It's not ever been that kind of, only the coasts watch. I mean, they've filmed on the coast, but I don't think that has been the case.
But if they were, if Donald Trump voters were, would they have responded? You know, would they have been changed in their views because of what Jimmy Kimmel or what other comedians might say? I mean, people, you know, people on the left, liberals, they've been reconfirmed in their dislike of Donald Trump, and they go, yeah, go for that. But there's kind of an emptiness in that, because we all know Donald Trump is, we all have our views of Donald Trump, and they're not that good, many of us, of a certain political persuasion. But I just wonder how that, you know, does comedy, does this satire change how people think? And we'll have to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it will just reinforce, oh, you're all against us, you are the liberal elites, etc., etc. I mean, I think when, I mean, which is, I think, what Jimmy Kimmel was trying to do. Jimmy Fallon, sorry, keep doing that. They were really just sort of saying, I get that. I get that you feel like that. And I'm really trying to find a way of talking to you that doesn't make you feel like that. And I think that's a reason. I mean, it's all you can do, really. I mean, I remember hearing a comedian, I think it might have been Tim Ferguson from the Doug Anthony All-Stars on Richard Herring's podcast, saying... the problem with Trump is that you say the thing that he's done and the audience laugh, and that's lazy. That's not comedy. You're not adding your own joke to that. And that's, you know, everyone says to comedians, oh, this must be a great time for you. Everything's so crazy right now. But actually, it's a lot harder to add a joke to a joke.
Well, I think actually that is a very good bridge to the ostensible focus of this podcast. Which is The Thriller by Sam Bourne, To Kill the President. Now, Sam Bourne isn't Sam Bourne. Sam Bourne is the pseudonym of, as it says here, of award-winning journalist and broadcaster Jonathan Friedland, who writes a column in The Guardian, has been, you know, has covered the United States politics and whatever, and he's kind of a well-known figure. Maybe Owen Jones and Paul Mason would call him a centrist on the kind of liberal Guardian left.
He's sort of quite considered political journalist.
Yes, he's a serious political journalist, but he's also got this kind of alternative career as Sam Bourne, writing thrillers, sort of fairly conventional thrillers about various political subjects, in actual fact. And the latest one, To Kill the President, well, I think you might guess, listener, from the title of it, is about a plot to assassinate the president. Now, this president, let's just cut to the chase, it's Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he's never actually named in the book, but, I mean, it's so blatant.
It is likely fictionalised, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Now, we chose it because... Well, you chose it, Emma, because we thought it was an interesting take on Trump, and we just were interested to think, yeah, to see what it might say, because just like comedy is often a platform for politics, thrillers have been a platform for all kinds of different politics. In fact, I think one of the best thrillers I've ever read is The 39 Steps by John Buchan, that was published just after. The start of the First World War, although it was written before the First World War. And John Buchan was a Conservative MP. And 39 Steps, although you can read it in any way you want, does have elements in which the author is warning the reader against the German threat and saying the liberals aren't taking it seriously enough. We need to build more ships. And so it's an absolute, it's a thriller, but it's about the German threat. It has a political purpose. And people have used Eric Ambler's thrillers of the late 30s, early 40s, where he is kind of popular front, where he's showing there is a German menace, there is this menace going on in Europe, and we need to be aware of it, and the Russians can help us. So there's all kinds of different political takes, and we talked about Chris Mullin's novel, didn't we?
Yes.
Very British Coup last time, and that was a left-wing thriller. Frederick Forsyth, at the same time in the 1980s, wrote right-wing thrillers about the Russian threat and how soft Neil Kinnock was and how he's going to be overthrown if the British were ever foolish enough to elect a Labour government in the 1980s and replaced by a hardline Marxist, not Jeremy Corbyn at that point, but I think maybe Ken Livingstone was mooted in that novel. So thrillers have lots of things, potential things to say. So we wondered, what did To Kill the President have to say about the Trump presidency in the thriller form. And I read a review of it in The Guardian, funnily enough, which was very praiseworthy. It was very, said very, very good, funnily enough, it being written in The Guardian. And Jonathan Friedland works at The Guardian. But it described it as a feminist thriller. And I wonder, Emma, what you thought about that.
Didn't really strike me as particularly feminist. Having a female protagonist
is not the same as being a feminist book.
Yes.
You know, she is...
This is Maggie Costello, who's an Irish... Who's Irish and has been in previous Sanborn novels as a kind of a peace negotiator, hadn't she? But she ends up in the... it's not Obama's White House.
Not the Obama White House, yeah.
Yes, it is Obama's White House. And she decides, for reasons that we aren't entirely clear about, at least at the start, she decides that she'll stay in the not Trump White House.
And she has this lover who she is completely and utterly beguiled by and behaves very stupidly as a result of this. So, I mean, and that for me is a bit kind of weak little woman, can't be trusted because of their hormones thing. She's dithery. I'm not entirely sure how she's a peace negotiator, plus seems to have brought peace to both the Middle East and the Congo. She gets abused and disabused by a lot of the male characters. She does very, very little to help a woman who is sexually abused by the president, which I don't think I'm making a massive spoiler there. You know, it's like, oh my God, I've just realised how bad the president is because he's done this thing that I've heard he's done 20 times already. And that's it. We never see that woman again. We never hear her story. We never have any sense of closure for her. And there was also, we took this one seriously because she had quite an important job, but we know he'd also done it to a cleaner. End of that story. I'm like, okay, that's not particularly feminist either because, you know, feminism is about solidarity between all women. And in the end, the MacGuffin that saves the day, I'm trying to do this with two spoilers, but I think anyone who knows that we're going to discuss something in depth should be aware there will be spoilers, is brought to her by a bloke. So I just, and the voice, even the voice in her head, and her mentor voice is a bloke. So anytime she needs to, oh, I don't really know what I should do. Oh, I do. I know, wise old Jewish man. And it's...
is that your wise old Jewish man voice?
Yeah. It was very good, wasn't it? But yeah, so I just... I didn't... Feminism, not so much. I mean, it's liberal, absolutely. Is it more feminist than Trump? Yes. What isn't? I think... But it didn't strike me. If one of the things they're trying to sell it on is, hey, yay, strong woman, I didn't get that sense reading it.
No. I mean, she's, as you say, she is a female protagonist, but she's got so many flaws. And also, that's just by having a female protagonist, as you did say, it's not... It was a bloke that said it was a female, so it was a feminist thriller, so I'm not sure his qualifications for being able to call it that. Oh, I don't know. But I think it was generally, though, quite disappointing because it was clearly written from a liberal perspective. It was written almost by and for Guardian readers. I don't think it told you anything that you might not have already imagined in your worst nightmares about Donald Trump. I mean, it starts off with the president just being annoyed at North Korea because North Korea has insulted him. And that just sends him mad. And he wants to press the nuclear button and he wants to drop the bomb on North Korea. He's stopped by a heroic female operative who, like you say, is kind of brushed under the carpets after that. But you can imagine in your worst nightmares that might happen. And of course, the last week or so, Trump has been saying various things. So we began to kind of think, oh, okay. But during the course of the narrative, it's just slightly nudging the characters that you believe operate in the actual White House, just taking them a little bit further, exaggerating things a little bit. There's a character who is clearly Steve Bannon. And instead of wearing cargo pants, he wears shorts. And it's somewhat more crude than the actual Steve Bannon, who, of course, now has left the White House. So already this novel is slightly out of date. Yes. But I just thought, you know, one of the purposes, you know, of novels, of thrillers, is to kind of outline a kind of a view of the subject that, you know, and it's meant to be entertaining. And but it's also meant to give you something that maybe you might not have taken from other sources of political information. And this didn't really tell me anything I didn't already think might, in my, as I say, in my wildest nightmares about Donald Trump. It didn't, it just took it slightly further down there. It didn't flip it. It didn't do anything with the subject. I mean, one of the best thrillers, and I strongly recommend it, is The Manchurian Candidate by Richard Condon, which is different to the film that was made immediately after with Frank Sinatra, and it's very different to the film that was subsequently remade by Jonathan Demme. And the whole point about The Manchurian Candidate, which was published in the late 50s, it's a parody of the communist scare in America at that point. And it was saying, well, you think there was a communist plot. I think that's ridiculous. This is what Richard Condon was saying, really. I think that's ridiculous. But in this novel, I'm going to give you a communist plot. I'm going to give you a communist plot that is so ridiculous, it makes you think that the idea of a communist plot is fatuous. And he did it in a really good way. It's very, very funny as well. So he completely flipped something.
Yeah.
Whereas what do we get in from To Kill the President? It's, well, you think Donald Trump's a bit crazy. I'm going to show you he's actual crazy. And you think Steve Bannon is this racist, kind of horrible, sexist person. I'm going to show you that he's a really bad, racist, sexist person.
And I think the Bannon character, I mean, he is clearly the Bannon character, even though he's called Mac in this.
Yes.
And he even just lays it out. I mean, I think we're going to hear a quick extract from the book now where he's just laying out what liberals think Bannon talks like.
You'll never understand that this man says what you'd say if your mouth didn't check with your brain first. He's that bit of you that would say to your friend, I really want to fuck your wife in the arse. But doesn't, because it's not done, it's not right, it's not politically correct. But guess what? He says it anyway. Black men, they're scary, they commit crime, and you'd rather not live next door to one. Hispanics, they're lazy and they cheat. Jews, rich, cunning, and you can't trust them. Gays, what they do to each other is sick and unnatural, and the idea of them marrying each other is a complete joke. Women between the ages of 16 and 70, you'd fuck most of them in the right light. And the ones you wouldn't, you'd rather not hear another word out of their fat, ugly mouths, thank you very much. Scratch that. Women between the age of 13 and 75. Gotta make room for Jane Fonda and those cute little twins from America's Got Talent. Wouldn't want to miss them out. Are you hearing me yet? Are you beginning to understand? The president is every white man in America with the filter taken off. Maybe not you guys, but the rest of us. And that's why they voted for him, because he's who they would be if they could get away with it. He makes billions, pays no tax, never pays his bills, dumps his wives as soon as they sag even a teeny bit, and marries a younger model. Literally. He insults everyone who gets in his way, says whatever he damn well likes, and he only gets richer and stronger. Gentlemen, don't you see? He's our national id, unbound and unleashed. He's the toddler within every one of us, allowed to run free. I want to eat that. I want to hit that. I want to fuck that. I want to own that. I want, I want, I want. And you know what? Everything he wants, he gets. It's beautiful. So of course they voted for him. He's like a fantasy. He's a dream come true. He's like America when it started, when white dudes could ride around this country on horseback, shooting Indians and screwing the squaws, taking whatever land they liked and dragging along some Negro on the end of the rope to do the dirty work. I mean, who wouldn't want that if they could get away with it? It's what we were raised on, boys like me, when we went to the movies on Saturday mornings. Cowboys weren't gay or Latino or female or gender fucking fluid. They were white and they were male and they were on top. That was their destiny. And now, after all these years, along comes this guy and he says, damn right, that's how it should be and that's how it will be again. I'm going to give you your job back, give you your self-respect back, and I'm going to put you back where you belong, back on top.
There you go.
Right, there you go. So I don't think it really gives us anything that a Guardian reader, you know, and I'm not sure, you know, I mean, lots of people read thrillers, so maybe it wouldn't just be Guardian readers who'll be reading this, but I think most people in Britain, and you know, certain kinds of people in the United States, this is telling them something they probably have already imagined.
Yeah, it's liberal wish fulfillment and liberal fear fulfillment, followed by liberal wish fulfillment. So yeah, it's reinforcing our conceptions rather than challenging them.
Mm. And I also had a thought, a random thought really, because I mean, when I started reading, I thought, oh yeah, this is good. This is a novel about, you know. And I thought, when I started it, oh, the actual assassination of a character who's very much like Donald Trump. But, well, you know, we don't have to say what exactly happens. But then at that point I began to think, but what are the ethics of this?
Mm.
Okay, so I'm someone politically that thinks Donald Trump's a terrible, terrible thing. But I don't think I would want to, unlike I think there's a state senator just recently in the United States that said she wished somebody would assassinate Donald Trump. I don't actually think it's, you know, I'm not going to go around and say, please will somebody kill Donald Trump. But here I am reading a novel where a likely fictionalized version of Donald Trump is mooted as being a fit subject for assassination. And this is an entertainment. I'm being entertained by the prospect. And I'm thinking, well, what would have happened if somebody, and maybe, you know, in the, you know, somewhere on the internet, somebody has written something about Obama being assassinated, you know, because there were plenty of people in the United States that thought Obama was a bad idea for America for all kinds of reasons. And on that basis, they could have imagined an Obama-like character being assassinated.
Yeah, we would have gone absolutely mental.
We would, yes.
Called them a racist, which they may well have been, but...
Indeed.
You know, if we start writing fantasy books about killing Trump, how are we better than people who fantasize about killing Obama? You know, what is the line? What is the moral code? Where does it stop? And you know, this argument, to be fair to Sam Bourne, Jonathan Friedland, this argument is articulated in the book. They both discuss whether the immediacy of the fact that he could kill the world by starting a nuclear war is therefore worth stopping, whilst knowing that by stopping him you would make him a martyr, right? And it would raise up a thousand Trumps for a thousand years, sort of thing. And that is discussed. That is a theme in the novel. I'm not sure it really gets resolved. They basically just decide, yeah, it's fine. And that's why Maggie is trying to stop the assassination, because she sees that, you know, it is a worse thing to do, even with the threat that he holds. And she seems to know, for someone who's not that senior, she seems to know what everyone's up to, including this whole, we might have gone to nuclear war, which I would have thought would be only knowledge amongst a very small circle. But there you go. That moral dilemma is discussed in it, but I didn't feel it was articulated in the same way as, you know, what if this had been on the other side?
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, it discussed it, it debated it, it kind of gave both sides to it. But the characters, you know, I think we broadly sympathised with the characters who were going through with the plot to assassinate the president. I think they were definitely people that we were invited to empathise with.
We were certainly invited to like them more than we were invited to like the Steve Bannon character who saves the president's life in many ways.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So I think, I mean, so far as I'm concerned, I mean, it's kind of a novel that maybe, you know, this is what it's designed for. Most thrillers are something to pick up at the airport and, what you know, read on the plane, read on the beach, and be mildly entertained. But I don't know that I would recommend it as anything more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a page turner. It keeps you entertained. It does its Dan Brown style job pretty well. That's what it's there to do. That's fine. But it doesn't, in terms of deeper political meaning, I think it in some ways reinforces that smug liberal left bubble image.
Yes, you will come out thinking, oh, that Donald Trump's even worse than I thought.
Yeah.
I think like
and yay us, we're so much more important and moral and good. And
yes.
And even when we're plotting to assassinate the president, we still get to be the more moral characters.
And it also gives us another reason for looking down at the people that did vote for Donald Trump, because there's a speech that the Steve Bannon character makes where he just basically it's as crude as the crudest possible explanation for Donald Trump, which is he's just exploiting these mugs who is saying he's going to do things for them, but there's no way he's going to. It's not intended to, which is kind of the kind of explanation that Paul Mason might see, but it's valid, but it's very crude. And that kind of sums up the novel thing. It's not really giving us a take on the subject that we might not have already had access to.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair. I think it's worth, I wouldn't recommend that it goes on anyone's, university politics lectures reading list, but if you're in an airport and you fancy a nice, reassuring, aren't I so good and liberal, but also a bit of a thriller read, then I would recommend it for a good 6-hour air flight.
Right, and if that's not damning with faint praise, I don't know.
Look, I've read four Dan Brown novels, so I have no right to talk to anyone about bad reading habits.
and I've read Jeffrey Archer novels as well. And I see that that's one of the quotes about how good it is from Jeffrey Archer, I think. So anyway, that's To Kill the President. And, you know, who knows, between this podcast listener and the next podcast, maybe the president will have killed us all. So we'll have to keep our fingers crossed.
So there'll be no third episode.
Fingers crossed. If only so there can be a third episode of this podcast. Please, Mr. President, just belay your fears of North Korea. So that's the end of this, our second, but hopefully not final podcast in the series. We'll be trying to work out what we want to talk about in time for the next podcast. But there is a Twitter feed, which I'm not sure how you've got this access to this podcast. But what's our Twitter address, Emma? It's completely forgotten.
ZT Podcast.
There you go. And if you want to suggest subjects for us to discuss or anything you want us to talk about at the next podcast or subsequent, please follow us and tweet us and we will pretend that we're listening to you.
And you can also find us. We have a website, which is zeitgeisttapes.com. And we're both on Twitter ourselves. I'm Emma Burnell _.
And I'm Pol Prof Steve.
Yeah. Great. Lovely. Oh, and also just again to say a quick thank you to Lord Wood of Anfield for our theme music. And this has been a Political Human production.
And we will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.